This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Francis Nally, and also Evie, who's never been on. He's never been on the show, but he's been a longtime fan. Evie, great to finally meet you, and also Francis, great having you on too.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you both.
I think I initially kind of came across you. You've said you've been like a longtime fan, and you've been in like various like these like group chats, but I don't think I've really talked to you that much until recently, but you make these like fan art kind of videos. Like there's one of me, one of Luke Ford, one of Jason Giorgiani on your YouTube channel, and there's like one of me. It's kind of making fun of me, but it's like it shows me taking pills and it says I'm gonna burn in hell, and it's like you make these like parodies of different people you know, and it's like also kind of like video collage art. Like Pilliter said, it kind of comes from like YTMND.com of around 2005 or Flesh World. But if you want to talk about I mean, it's obviously not too serious, but it is very creative, but you want to talk about what you do with your YouTube channel.
Sure. Just to clarify, those were two separate videos. The one where it was talking about burning in hell and stuff, that one was it came off a little more mean-spirited than I had intended, so I took that down. But the initial one where you were,
The Truth where is you Stark. Were probably,
yeah, the Truth is Stark. That's the one I liked, and that was done, as it says, in the little liner notes underneath. It says, done with love, not malice, for the mysterious figure known as Robert Stark.
Okay.
Yeah, with the Suspiria music, the Goblin soundtrack. That whole channel, basically my YouTube channel, the one you're referencing, is it's not a serious art project. It's really an inside joke for me and like 15 people. But yeah,
one of Luke Ford, and I forget what he's talking about, but Luke Ford is talking about rape. Is that? Did you make that? That's something else.
Not the rape. That's something else, but it's I know what you're referencing. This one, the one I made, was called Eroticized Rage.
Oh, that's kind of right.
Along the lines, yeah.
Yeah, Eroticized Rage. I wonder, like, if you saw my documentary Supply, if that's
yes,
your
I did.
Idea. Okay.
I think I might have even gotten some footage from it for that to splice up.
That was a little while back with Matt
it was
P.
Fun. With the three parentheses around it, which was pretty hilarious. But
right. We did an edited version to send to the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. We removed the triple parentheses. We did that because Luke Ford used to do that around his name, but some people might take it the wrong way.
Yeah, easily taken the wrong way. But, I mean, it's not to say that I don't put any effort into these things, but, anything I work on, I'm going to want it to be cool. But it's not like I spend an extraordinary amount of time editing these works. But I'm glad you brought it up, because it
are
is
you,
a part of...
Are you an artist? Like, do you have other art projects going on?
Yeah, I am an artist. I was a musician without doxing myself completely, because I still kind of operate anonymously in these spheres, or I try to, somewhat. I do have a past in music. This is going back, you know, I'm in my late 30s. So this is going back. I'm a millennial. This is going back to millennial times.
Will you say kind of hipster, like indie rock scene?
Very much so.
In Brooklyn?
That. New Jersey, primarily. And yeah, the surrounding tri-state area. I was on It depends on the project. I'm a creative person, so they're really save for the past couple years of my life where I have not been that active, where I've really been. That's why you see weird things like my YouTube channel popping up, because I don't have a real focus right now. I'm trying to change that, but I'm a father now, and you know, that's taking a lot of my time. But in the past, I was always in different musical projects. I was in metal projects, and a lot of the kind of the indie scene, really, primarily. And I'm talking signed to a label for a time, and was actually kind of making, not breaking even, making not rolling in cash or anything. You don't roll in cash unless you're, I don't know, Lana Del Rey, but make at least doing it for real competitively.
Is there like a New Jersey scene, and it revolves? I think Francis could explain this better, but it revolves around certain people like we've had on and who he knows. But it's sort of creative, but it's maybe vaguely like kind of loosely affiliated with the dissident right, but it's not really political. It's more like a kind of a creative scene. And
well, these days, who knows what's going on? Yeah, if it's
Alex Goldstein.
Yeah, Alex Goldstein, and maybe would you say? Yeah, he was my co-host a long time ago.
Well, Alex Goldstein, his band was Harpoon Forever, and they later started Garcia People without them, and they just opened up for Pavement not too long ago. But Goldstein, he's in the Rutherford area, but went to college in New Brunswick. And there's a lot of interesting things that do happen in New Brunswick, because that's Central Jersey area.
The whole basement show scene, yeah.
Right. Harlan Benison, too, was also on Stark Truth some time ago. But I do think certain Central Jersey area, I wouldn't say it's dissident, but I would say there was an early current of internet culture.
Well, kind of a precursor to Dime Square, but maybe like Dime, sort of like Dime Square, but a precursor to it, and maybe like more authentic.
I
don't think that's wrong at all. Yeah.
I guess I have mixed feelings about Dime Square. Like, it is, I think it's a force for good, because you have people who are open-minded about dissident politics, and it attracts creative people, and it does give some degree of normie status, but there's obviously going to be, like, status chasers and people who are pretty much, like, generic hipsters from 10 years ago who are looking for a new niche. So I've been to events associated with some of those people. I don't think against them, but I guess my feelings about Times Square are kind of nuanced and mixed.
I would agree. Mine are too. I mean, people have a tendency to kind of wash up into Times Square. I'm not talking about the actual people at the center of it, but maybe people on the periphery of it. And to get back to the New Jersey scene and kind of what it is, the essence of it, this is going to sound like a throwback, but I mean, like, to give you kind of an idea of the milieu I was in at one time when I was younger, my band was in, was signed to Eyeball Records. So I was kind of in that milieu. And, that for those who are unfamiliar with it, My Chemical Romance's first album was like released on Eyeball. Now, I'm not saying we weren't working in that genre of music. Eyeball has its, tentacles in all sorts of genres, but that underground, that kind of level of underground where you could kind of jump off from there, you know, if the gods see it for you. But it's changed a lot in the past 10 years, I'd say. I mean, there's a huge jump between kind of millennial-led.
Oh, yeah, because that's like all millennial culture. And millennials are kind of approaching middle age, and then Zoomers are kind of doing something totally different.
Yeah, yeah. Although you'll see echoes of it. Like,
that's true.
I mean, certainly.
It's weird because, like, you think hipster culture is dead, but then I go to hipster sections of LA and I notice there's, like, Zoomer hipsters, too.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, you're always going to get that to some extent. And,
kind of like in the past, like, there were Gen Xers who were hippies in some cases, in certain places.
Yeah, they weren't all post-punk anti-hippie. Right. Right.
So you say, you describe yourself more as like an apolitical like artist. With you're not really like super ideological. But if you want to kind of give like a brief introduction to your political and philosophical background and viewpoint.
Sure. I wouldn't describe myself as apolitical now, but most of my life I was apolitical. Even until I sort of got in, I got into these dissident spheres in like I'd say 2015-ish.
It's interesting because you kind of got attracted to the scene. You could, I guess, you could say it's alt-right, despite actually being more actually like you'd say you're actually more leftist. You kind of ended up being associated with like the dissident right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely. And keep in mind, I found figures like Pill Eater, yourself, and like Brandon Adamson fairly early too. So I was able to justify it like that way as well. That, oh, there's a cool avant-garde in this scene. You know what I mean? So, yeah. I mean, I describe myself as, I'm not an economics bro, so it's not like I'm a leftist necessarily, like, autistically concerned with economics.
So you're not like some Marxist ideologue, you're just sort of, like, vaguely, like, left-leaning in economics.
Yeah, or a creature of the left, I've called myself before in trying to describe myself to people. Or, like, and I know this is kind of a bad word these days, but socially, I'm not exactly socially conservative in every, you know, way either, at least compared to some of these guys who I meet these days in trad circles.
Oh, like you have the whole, like the kind of the trad, like third positionists who are like hardline nationalists, economically left wing, but they're like hardcore social conservatives. So like you're neither like an economic or a socially like right-leaning person. So what is it about it that puts you at odds with like the left and like the dominant kind of liberal society?
Well, you know, the id poll stuff, I'm not anti-id poll all around. I think the future is going to be increasingly identity politics, but the anti-white stuff was a turnoff. You know, that's when you know, I don't like that. I have a little white daughter that I'm trying to raise in this world, too. So, you know, that was really what kind of kicked things off for me. I remember in 2015, I remember, like, I had a little infant baby, so I had a lot more time on my hands. I was newly married at that point. And I was spending more time on like YouTube, and I like discovered all these figures and kind of the whole microstream community, like the Luke Ford stuff. And that was a cool way to kind of be eased into this world, this political realm. I remember coming across Millennial Woes and, you know, obviously this is the Richard Spencer era.
All right.
Pre Fuentes. But yeah, so I mean that's sort of where I come in. So I'm very familiar with all the incarnations since.
Even like Countercurrents, like they are pretty like Greg Johnson's Countercurrents, they are pretty radical on like racial issues. But I do think what's interesting about them is they had a kind of like a right wing kind of bohemian scene. And a lot of interest in like culture and like really esoteric thinkers and a lot of our artistic stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when I was first getting into this, I bought Greg Johnson's, where is it? It's on my shelf somewhere here. Something about the, here it is, New Right and the Old Right. You know,
I
like some.
I've seen that. Maybe I've seen like the article version of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not a regular reader of Countercurrents these days, but I know Pill Eater follows them a little more. Yeah. I mean, he's critical.
There's some like drama going back, which we don't really need to get into. There was this scene called like the left wing of the alt-right or the alt-left. And then the alt-left kind of became associated with like the class reductionist left. And then like Trump used it to describe Antifa. But initially, yeah, I remember, like, there was a scene, like, Brandon Adamson used to have this website, alt-left.com, which is defunct.
I remember. Yeah. Before Trump's comments.
Yeah.
The left of the alt-right. I remember it. I loved that. And I found that very early in my, you know, political awakening.
Would you say, do you identify with class reductionist leftism, or you would critique them for being class reductionist? And they neglect, like, culture and identity?
Yes, I would critique them. Now, I'm sorry if I'm splitting my wires in some ways. In some ways, I'm kind of at odds with myself, but I'm certainly more on the culture side and the identity side.
It may maybe sound kind of convoluted, but if you talk about, like, but you could have, like, right-wing and left-wing, like, radical centrist approaches.
Well, definitely.
So I would say, like, co-opt the avant-garde against, like, corporate liberalism, and then you would have, like, instead of, like, opposing multiculturalism, you would have a right-wing multiculturalism, which would include, it would have to be inclusive of whites, but it would also include, like, something like enclavism and be more pluralistic. And then a right-wing socialism to challenge left-wing socialism instead of capitalism. So it just means, like, investing in things that advance civilization rather than just bureaucracy. And then embrace things like urbanism, and which is, like, promoted by the left, but a positive vision for urbanism. And you can embrace, like, New Age spirituality, but kind of co-opt that. So it's interesting. It's interesting kind of, like, dialectic. So instead of taking the reactionary approach, you take things associated with the left, but you rework them into something superior.
Well, isn't that the job of the avant-garde in any...
Yeah, so capacity? Like, so you basically say, and it's a way to kind of fuck with people, so you say, like, I'm an avant-garde socialist multiculturalist.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of room to turn things on its head. And even if I see attempts at that, you know, in these spheres on Twitter and stuff, and I can get behind that even if I'm not the attempt, even if I'm not behind the mission per se. If we're thinking in that way, if we're creative that way, then we deserve to be to call ourselves an avant-garde. I mean, some of this is grim. Some of this I see, you know, I see one of the things I rail against often is this kind of Fuentesian kind of thing that I just don't vibe with, that whole kind of incel culture where it's just WQ all the time. I mean, granted, his mission is very different from, you know, mine, if I were to have one.
You would, like, prefer, like, you prefer, like, the 2015 Richard Spencer to Fuentes by far.
In a lot of ways, yeah. In a lot of ways.
And Spencer was interesting because he was neither right, he was, I mean, if you want to say he was racist, okay, fine, but he was neither right-wing on social issues or economics. And he was definitely more of a Swipple who fit in with kind of like upper middle class liberal cosmopolitan aesthetics. He was not not a conservative.
Not at all. And I really vibed with that too. And when I saw that was, you know, keep in mind, I was kind of newly politicized or thinking in political terms. And that was exciting to see what was possible in that sense. What was happening out there. So, and he's still doing his thing. He's still out there, but he has maybe a tiny percentage of the audience he used to have since the irony bro takeover.
You said you have a French mentality in terms of temperament and culture and philosophy. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, let me also say philosophy would be misleading. I'm not a philosophy guy. I'm a psychology guy. That's just kind of how right. So, and that's kind of very French too. Even their philosophers are a little like that. But you know, like, for instance, I mean, one thing I always say is, like, there is no ad hominem fallacy. Like, everything is ad hominem. Like, that's, it's, everything is about psychology. But yeah, French, I'm of French and Italian ancestry. So, Ellis Island, kind of, my family came over here. They were not founding stock Americans, but yeah, like, very French, very French. Film is a huge interest of mine. Writing, kind of, bohemian. I'm fairly bohemian. Now, granted, I'm also a functional member of society, especially these days. Maybe I'm getting over my more wild days that I've lived in the past. But I have lived a relatively wild life. Tremendous ups and tremendous downs. So,
with your culture and aesthetic preferences, you have a strong passion for avant-garde film. And then also, visual aesthetics, do you have any strong, like, preferences for visual aesthetics? Or you're pretty open-minded and eclectic in your taste?
Yeah, I think you and I were talking about this in one of the group chats the other day. I don't even want to, I'm not so open-minded that my brains fall out. I have a very singular vision for my own work. But yes, I'm a very visual thinker. I'm a very visual person, and the film medium has always spoken to me. I mean, I'm surrounded right now as we speak by my film.
Do you like
core.
The David Lynch, like his visual aesthetics in his in cinema?
Well, David Lynch, he's cool. I mean, he has a very static. He doesn't move the camera.
That's true.
He isn't the most visual director. I would look to the Italians, probably for more visual directing, or even Japanese, or the French. I mean, French cinema, it doesn't really get much better than that. But I mean, I like Lynch. I love Lynch. He's and about just, mood though.
Yeah, mood. Well, I guess films that are like surreal and aesthetics. Like I think,
eighties
eighties films. 80s cinema is definitely goes for the whole surreal look with like different with like the coloring. And I guess like I think of like Schrader's Mishima, Life in Four Chapters. I even did a painting inspired by that. Like that's a really aesthetic film.
Absolutely. It really is. It doesn't really flow that well the screenplay, but visually that's what carries that film. Paul Schrader is he's had a really interesting career.
Would you say, like, the theme of surrealism, where it's aestheticism is, like, the emphasis on beauty, but just really trying to create, like, an ethereal or otherworldly or hypnagogic, like, feeling in cinema?
Hypnagogic.
Right.
That's an interesting way to put it, kind of the,
It seems to be, like, with that, like... Like, surrealism, it really peaked, like, in the 80s for some reason.
Everybody's very quick to, you know, obviously, David Lynch is our pop surrealist, our American pop popular surrealist. But, I mean, like, you're right. Even, like, the films of Raul Ruiz, who's my favorite surrealist, even, well, aside from maybe, like, Buñuel or somebody. And Raul Ruiz... Unfortunately, nobody really knows about him because half of his films don't have DVD or Blu-ray releases these days. So only like real nerds know about him. But he really peaked in the 80s as well. Now, if you're asking like what are some speculative reasons for that? Yeah,
I would say like the right balance of technology where there were advancements, but it was the right. Kind of this like Goldilocks zone where there were more advances in technology, but at the same time everything didn't become like totally digitalized, but also a kind of balance between like more cultural openness and creativity, but then that kind of became a fad. I mean, technology is a big aspect, but everything in cinema feels so sterile today with like the CGI and just A lot of it just has to do with technology.
Yeah,
but also, you're... like, true with a lot of, like, also with, like, horror films, too, from the era.
Well, the horror film, unfortunately, I mean, we see some cool things. You know, A24 is interesting. I know they get a lot of praise, so I almost don't even want to concentrate on them. But I would say technology, like you said, I think also because as we were moving into the 80s, that was the end of the kind of director-led era in mainstream Hollywood, and it was kind of going into its corporate model that we're so familiar with today. So there were these outliers, these kind of bad boys of cinema, operating on the outskirts, not within the studio system, and they were surrealists. So it was kind of a rebirth in that way as well.
And then with architectural or artistic aesthetics, you don't really have a strong like prejudice or bias. You have pretty eclectic taste in aesthetics when it comes to visual art and when it comes to architecture.
Yeah, like I'm not going to make a statement like I don't like brutalism. Like, because there are so many exceptions to that. And, you know, but I love Gothic architecture. So, yeah, I hate to make sweeping statements about stuff like that, at least.
There are, like, the trad types who are really rigid about architectural aesthetics, who hate any modern architecture. But there, on the other hand, like, I didn't notice, like, the alt-right really embraced, like, retrofuturism as an aesthetic, which is good.
Yeah. Yes. You know, I still haven't read that Guillaume Fay book, that famed book, but I've been wanting to.
Yeah, I haven't read it either, but I'm not sure how much it really goes into like the
art,
aesthetic
right.
or built space component, but I should read it at some point. I've been putting that off. Do you believe that beauty is objective or subjective? Like, is there a hierarchy?
Ooh. God, you're hitting me with the hard ones. I'm willing to operate within social constructs, even if I'm maybe a postmodernist in the sense that I'm willing to kind of flip-flop and want to say everything's subjective, but I'm perfectly content to operate within social constructs that I myself like while realizing it's a social construct, if that makes sense. So I'm going to say, I would say beauty is subjective, however, it might as well be objective because I have my opinions and feelings on the subject. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think, I mean, social constructs, there's nothing wrong with them.
Right, right.
As long as you have some awareness of it, but there's nothing wrong with it, there's nothing inherently bad about it. Would you say that the Philistine who hates art and high culture, are they the true enemy?
I agree. Pillater's been pushing that lately.
Yeah,
and
he's
been
pushing that.
I wrote that in the
You wrote outline. That in the outline, right.
So,
and there's something to that. I mean, I'm an elitist. I am. I would be lying. I mean, my friends call me a champagne socialist, and I lean into that. I actually wear that as a badge of honor. I'll advocate socialism while talking down to the prole. But, like, you know, it is what it is. I have bumped up against that my entire life. So I did vibe with that when Pillager was talking about that.
It was interesting because Alan Watts said something interesting. He said that the French placing a strong value on aesthetics as a principle, that they're actually, because the French are true materialists, the Americans have this weird like Gnostic dualism about where they're materialistic, but they also have like this religious dualism where it's kind of dirty. So the aesthetics become like low quality because they have this kind of like, they almost view it like idolatry. That's what Alan Watts said. Do you view aesthetics in materialistic terms, or do you think that there is like a spiritual component?
I'm going to venture to say I see it more in spiritual terms. However, not in that typical American real kind of bogged down in Christianity sense, a dualist Christianity sense. And again, to the extent that's possible, but at least my feeling about it is that it's a more mystical kind of feeling about it. That's how I would describe myself anyway.
So not, well, yeah, like aesthetics, like it creates an ethereal aura. So you can,
yeah.
There's like this dichotomy between cultural and economic elitism. So like you say you're like a champagne socialist. And it's kind of ironic because like I'm very much like against the liberal order, but I have the same time like being like the irony is like being culturally elitist but economically populist, like you end up ironically having more in common with like more bohemian people on the left than you do with a lot of conservatives. But I would say like because economic pop, because like MAGA populism, a lot of it is like it's culturally pro, but economically it's fairly right wing, and like that you see like Trump cutting taxes of corporations and the wealthy, but a lot of the populism is actually like cultural populism rather than economic populism. So it is ironic that if you're like an economic populist but cultural elitist, like you ironically, like even though like you can detest like the liberal establishment, you ironically by that you end up having more in common with people on the left, even though that did apply to a lot of people like on the alt-right. But I would just say like fundamentally economic elitism is an enemy of cultural elitism, and culture and economic elitism tends to have like the outcome of like cultural egalitarianism.
Well,
so,
that's
like, the interesting,
sort of
like, the dichotomy is, like, how capitalism versus left-wing economics, like, how it relates to dichotomies, like, about cultural elitism.
The whole MAGA communism thing was an attempt to kind of culture jam that tendency that you're kind of talking about and kind of flip it on its head. To you know, who knows how successful that was. I did think it was interesting in that sense, though. But yeah, I personally, I'm more interested in culture. Economics was kind of an afterthought for me. All that stuff, you know, that I was saying in the beginning, all this kind of posturing left, right, even kind of labeling it that way, calling myself a creature of the left is a kind of, I mean, I think it's a correct way to describe myself, but it's a posture. It is a posture, and it's derived from my cultural elitism and my sort of being hyper focused on culture. And
because the way things work is because capitalism is culturally egalitarianism, because if you want to make the most profit, you have to sell to the most people, because there is like the small elite group who have the best culture and aesthetic sensibilities, the most creative. Because there's less people out there like them, it's harder for them to become economically successful. So that's the dichotomy.
Well, I think we're approaching, even in kind of like, let me use popular music as an example. I think we're kind of approaching an aesthetic sophistication even in popular music. I think music is one realm that kind of differs with other mediums. I don't see like other mediums. I see we're kind of, we never got past, I don't think we're truly doing anything new. That the boomers, the kind of boomers haven't done thoroughly. We're kind of doing iterations of that over and over. Even the return to kind of traditional values is a kind of play on that. It's not really getting outside of that net. However, with music, I think that's the one, you know, place in art that I'm seeing. I don't really know how to articulate it yet, but I've been seeing it happening, and I think it's kind of exciting. and worth mentioning.
Oh, yeah. And I think what's interesting is, like, you talk about, like, I think, like, a lot of race, if you take an issue like racism and, like, what drives a lot of, like, dissident right politics, a lot of it is, like, aesthetically driven by, and sexually driven by, like, aesthetic preferences. So you have, Pilliter here has, like, Asian Aryanism, and he's basically basing his political philosophy, I don't know if this is an exaggeration, but on his sexual desirability. And a lot of, like, the dissident right, they view like being blonde, like the blonde kind of like Aryan or Nordic look as the ideal, and they want more people like that, and they channel them to politics. So yeah, like there is this like sexual component. Basically, like people want more of the people they find sexually desirable. But the thing is, my stance on this is I think it's better to just be honest about that and just say that than try to sublimate that into reactionary politics. Like, or it's unhealthy to put like these subconscious desires into politics without like really being honest and direct about it. So like great idea, like racial preservation should just be explicitly like an aesthetic issue, and instead of endlessly going on about reactionary views ranging from like conspiracy theories to obsessing over all these just very statistics. So like embrace like sexual racism on aesthetic grounds is healthier than sublimating that into reactionary politics, because basically all politics is about posture, but the underlying motives are subconscious psychosocial and psychosexual desires.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And politics as posture. And there is a power to what you're saying about, you know, why don't you just out with it and be forward.
Well, that's what Pilliter does. Like, he has like a fetish for Asian women, so he wants to build like his Hapa ethno state and call it Asian Aryanism. And he's explicit about that. And like the same with like the alt-right, like the blonde Aryan woman in like the wheat field, is it is using, at least like they're using aesthetics to put an image of the society they want to ideally live in. But I mean, the left is going to shame that as like bigotry, but the problem with the right is that they channel it into all these other things that are a total distraction. So just, okay, fine, like politics should be about aesthetics. I think that's one component, but also like be honest, people should be more honest about like the psychosexual dynamics as well. But I do think right. Like politics should be about aesthetics.
Well, I think at least in the past Pilliter would have taken issue with the word fetish, and I think,
well, he's here, Pilliter, yeah. Any objective to how I described your ideology?
I think that's totally accurate for someone who's normal, liberal, politically correct. Though I don't want to play word games here, but the word fetish is interesting. Little digression here. Fetish also means to give power to something. It's not objectification, like an object-oriented ontology.
That's what I was going to bring up. It's not necessarily objectifying something.
And the thing is that the word fetish is a type of irrationalism, because liberalism is about rationality. But it's not about sincerity. It's ironic. It has to be outside to always observe. So to be irrational means you're not in liberal power or liberal choice, which sounds kind of ironic, because liberalism is about the ideology of individualism and not so much the power of choice. And so liberals get upset when people have sincere convictions. So they call things fetish because they think it's irrational when preference and desire is a rational thing.
And you would agree with the statement that it's just I think people should just be upfront about all that.
Well, if you don't know Douglas Kim, he is this bizarre CPI member, Korean American, who blames a white male Asian female as a form of imperialism and uses tanky communist rhetoric that if we got away the supposed menace of white male, Asian female, and replaced it with poetic justice, Asian male, white female, supposedly communism would rule the world and fascism is an embodiment of white male, Asian female. But like what Robert is saying, this is basically rhetoric to justify hatred for white men and for some weird niche ideology on incel motivations. So if rhizomic happenstance of Douglas Kim is plausible, then a rhizomic happenstance of being a white nationalist into My Little Ponies is all plausible. Therefore, we must respect all outcomes.
I get where that's coming from. I think I tend to do that automatically. But I think we're seeing a lot of, in general, a lot of specifically Asian male meltdowns in current liberal society in competition.
That's the other angle, I think. That there's one angle is people visualize, they have like their sexual ideal and they want more people like that, and then that's channeled into politics. And I think there's like psychosexual, there's intersexual competition between different ethnic groups over women. And I think because saying so, it signals either bigotry or it signals like having a low social status. So it's channeled into other things. So there's like, here's what Pilliter is talking about, like the Asian male resentment is channeled into more using liberal arguments rather than just being blatant that they don't want white men to take their women. So you're saying,
right? Yeah, let's dress it up in Marxist terms in the CPI case example, and yeah, that gets really tiresome.
It is signaling. It signals a low social status. But I would just, but part of me is just saying I wish people would just be honest about it, and it shouldn't be, there shouldn't be any moral stigma. But that's obviously not going to happen.
Well, that's the trick. I mean, one-on-one, I mean, I psychoanalysis could cure all in some ways, but, or have that,
It's like the whole thing, like the woke, it's weird because, like, I wrote an article about this, like the woke idea of implicit bias is like, on one hand, it is anti-white, but on the other hand, it is kind of true that people's implicit subconscious biases influence everything. And I kind of, like, I don't know if, I mean, in general, I prefer Jung to Freud, but actually there is some legitimacy to, like, Freudianism. I think people should just look inward and figure out what their subconscious biases are and just sort of, maybe manage them better. But, yeah, so the whole idea is, like, you have, like, well, on one end, you have, like, the demagogic populist who exploits people's like subconscious desires into like their own agenda. But then the other extreme is like you have like the liberal rationalist who tells you that like your intuitive subconscious desires are something that are illiberal and dirty. So I'm really just think people should just sort of embrace these kind of motives. Like, so it includes like a number of things. It includes like, and it does relate, this does like relate to things like race and sexuality, which are like the two big taboos. But people need to be honest, or at least honest with themselves.
Definitely. There's also, I mean, especially when it centers around, you know, race and stuff like that, it's going to get touchy. But I mean, these are feelings based things, and
well, they're shaped by evolution and evolutionary psychology, so they shouldn't be dismissed.
Sure. Evo psych is a thing. I tend to kind of actually downplay some parts of that. However, people aren't comfortable with their feelings in general, and I think a real emphasis of mine as well is maybe sometimes getting into those places that we don't feel as a society, too. Hopefully,
people people feel guilt about like a racist thought, or people also feel like guilt about like their sexual fantasies.
Well, definitely, I'm not sure we'll ever conquer that completely. But
no, definitely not.
Well, certainly in the realm of ideas, like when we're all, I don't know, on Twitter and stuff like that, I guess it's a this constant pursuit to have a take, and this ever growing pursuit to have an ever growing amount of novel takes. That's kind of the game. But like, at least, you know, when people are, groups of people are talking to each other like this, maybe that's the best we could hope for, is people being honest in that kind of environment, but, and with themselves, like you said. But I don't know. I mean, in a public facing kind of environment where, you know, we're trying, where it's performative.
I think another example of this is like conservatives support like right-wing policies that like right-wing economics that screw over, that end up screwing over like working class whites because they have like a, because they do have like a racial motive that they're, that they, that's so taboo they can't be honest about it.
Oh, well, the GOP is a whole different story with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
I mean, even in the dissident realm where we are bringing up these, where we can talk about race, we're even kind of posturing in all these kind of weird ways. So imagine what the, you know, the GOP is 100 times worse, or I won't even say worse. I would just say different and maybe even more goofy in the way they do it.
Because, yeah, I actually do think, I think, like, leftists are correct that a lot of white people do have, like, subconscious racial motives, biases.
Definitely.
I mean, everyone does, because no one is, like, it's naive to say you can be, like, totally colorblind.
That, I've never, in my experience, I don't think I've ever, I don't buy it. I don't buy it, personally. Colorblindness.
Is right-wing moralism as bad as left-wing moralism?
Yes. At least in the ways I've seen it manifest. The kind of...
They both have their moral-like hysterias.
Certainly. I mean, the satanic panic that we're kind of reliving now, that happened in the 80s. I mean, people would call me blue-pilled for even calling it that. You know, in the Tradcath spheres, but I mean, I'm culturally Catholic. I was raised in a Catholic family. I'm French Italian. I mean, I like church. I push my daughter goes to CCD, but you know, I'm not an especially devout Catholic. But yeah, we see a lot of, I think we're rehashing the 80s in a lot of ways. It's almost kind of quaint to say so.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have, like, thoughts on, like, the philosophical question on human nature and, like, the debate between, like, De Sade or Nietzsche on one end and Rousseau on the other? And, like, human nature, like, whether there's a consistency? Because logicians never, they never really can make sense out of people. And... But yeah, like you would also say like philosophy, it does have to be based on intuition and experience. But if you have thoughts, like this thoughts on like the question like on human nature, and if there's any way to, you can't really like, it's just too chaotic to really try to like put it in a box.
Yeah, the uber philosophy bro-ism is not my bag. You know, teleology and all that stuff. It's like what you said. Intuition is a strong philosophical binding, I think. Intuition alone, almost. Going out and winging it, stuff like that would be kind of my philosophizing. But I think the book reading in the philosophy realm, I haven't done a lot of. I'm told by guys who have done a lot more philosophy reading than me that I'd be kind of maybe new Hegelian in some ways and certainly postmodernist in other ways, maybe in like a... There's even some Judith Butler that I vibe with, believe it or not. She's actually fairly reactionary in some surprising ways.
Well, it's interesting because both like the vitalist on the right and like the kind of hippie new age lefties, like both believe in intuition. But I guess there is like... But like the rationalist types, they definitely downplay it, or they reject it even.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, I mean, there's someone's rhetoric, and there's what they really do too. It's hard to say. It's hard to say.
So what do you mean by elf idealism? That's something that I think Pilliter sent to me in an outline.
Interesting. Elf idealism. I'm actually unfamiliar with the idealism part. Maybe that's more Pilliter's piggybacking.
Yeah,
on,
that's on, I had. It, yeah.
Well, it's the elf. So you can explain what elf is and an ideology of the elf.
Yeah, sure. As goofy as this may sound, because it's going to kind of sound like a, this doesn't come from like a Lord of the Rings Tolkien fan base type place in myself. I have just always kind of girls resemble elf to me, and I purposely say elves and not like elves because elves sounds too Tolkien, and I do a kind of a purposeful low English version of it, which is elves because it just sounds funnier. But I'm very pro female. I don't have these hang-ups. How do I say this without coming off like I'm talking down to people? I've done fairly well with women in my life. You know, I don't have that kind of incel core mentality. And that's actually one of my biggest qualms with these dissident spheres these days. Now the term is radfem. The whole radfem thing came into fashion. But before that, you know, I was just, I don't know what you would call it. But nowadays I say I'm relatively pro radfem. Like, because I can kind of, I can see things their way, and I don't have the same hang-ups, I'd say, that a lot of other men have. And I think it's a very widespread thing. I'm not even trying to give too much of a value judgment to it. I mean, I'm very critical of it, but, like, I'm not an enemy of men. I am a man. But, you know, so it's very strange. Learning, it kind of blindsided me when I realized that I would say even 90% of this stuff isn't about race. It's about WQ for most guys in dissident spheres.
So you generally like, you strongly like dislike the manosphere. Is it, in that whole scene, is it that you disagree with their fundamental, like, arguments, or is it more that you think the scene is, like, totally cringe, like how they present themselves?
It's not just surface-level stuff like that, although I think it is cringe. Listen, I'm not out to make fun of a guy who went MGTOW because he lost everything and he got screwed over in court and he can't see his kids or something. I'm not against that guy. I'm against, like...
Like the grifters?
I guess incel grifter types, Fuentes stuff. I think gender warring, I'm not even saying don't gender war. I mean, some of this has to be...
I think the issues have to be discussed.
Yeah, openly. That's one thing. But I guess the ways I've been seeing it go down is pretty, I don't know, there are very few manosphere talking points I vibe with as a man. And I am not a, like I said, I've had plenty of experience in this realm, and I'm not really passive, quote, I'm not the passive one in my own relationships. So, I mean, I live one way, and I just haven't had these troubles that a lot of these guys seem to talk about. And I think it actually comes from a lot of what I see in the manosphere realm in general is like hypothetical outrage. These guys whipping each other into frenzies about things they haven't experienced firsthand. They're reading, you know, Twitter comments about someone else, presumably somebody else's experience or some fiction about an experience. And it gives the kind of impression that both sides, I mean, the men and the females, I've seen some of this on the female side.
And I think
too,
one angle of this is because people are atomized, then these online narratives take over. So a lot of people do. I mean, sure, I don't want to moralize it because a lot of people have had a pretty tough situation in life, and they're right to feel angry or resentful. But at the same time, I guess the problem is because of atomization, people allow these online narratives to take over. When they're even if there's truth to it, there are downsides to that as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, yeah, it's about technology, increasing atomization, and echo chambers and how that kind of functions. And I'm not necessarily proposing some way out of this. I'm not sure what to do. I mean, I guess Kaczynski proposed some ways out of this, but, here we are. We're here, and this is what we're dealing with. And I'm in my late 30s, and I'm thankful in a lot of ways that, I grew up when I did, but at the same time, by the same token, I tell a lot of guys who are younger than me, it's not all that different. I grew up, the internet was raging at the time. It was an earlier internet, but it was
probably about the same age as me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And so you know what I'm saying. I mean, people kind of have this idea.
We were seeing the onset of these trends, but I think they really accelerated in the 2010s.
Sure. And that's
maybe
when
the 00s, there was probably there was still more people doing stuff IRL and more social capital. Though I lived in LA, so that's a pretty crazy place to grow up.
Sure, surely. I mean, I'm on the coast as well. I mean, New Jersey, very close to New York City, kind of in the shadow of New York City, coast, northeast coast. So there's probably a lot of similarities there. But I it was the same things occurring, just kind of an earlier iteration of them. So I like to kind of keep focus on that with younger people.
It kind of goes back to the dialectic I mentioned earlier, and it's kind of my own unique philosophy where you have the liberal who tells you that the liberal will tell you that you're a racist and a misogynist, and then the demagogue will try to exploit those sentiments you have to fulfill their agenda. So I think the solution is to just sort of tell them both to kind of fuck off, and then just try to figure out a more honest assessment of reality. And ironically, I am kind of becoming becoming a rationalist in a sense, which is ironic, but I think that's the way you have to do it. Just try to create an honest assessment of reality.
I think another thing, I think one of the main underpinnings to what I find off-putting about maybe this incel culture is, you should fear a man who feels inadequate in some ways. I mean, I'm not conflating normal insecurities.
I don't think people should be shamed about feeling that way. If people have had if someone's alienated and had a rough time in life, I don't think they should be morally shamed.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm not conflating normal insecurities or whatever path you have led. You know, that's one thing, and talking about it, and being upfront with that, this is who I am. That's one thing. I'm talking about when it's feeding on each other, and I'm speaking of inadequacy as a constant disposition, it almost becomes your identity. And in a group situation, when that feeds off each other.
Right.
That's just a toxic feedback loop. It's unfortunate. I'm not even necessarily blaming the guy in the middle of that. But that what's occurring there is not good.
They're called the culture, not the individual.
Right.
I think one other angle about the manosphere that's interesting, because on one hand, you think of the dissident right as being pretty racist and anti-black, but I think one thing that's ironic is that the manosphere, their ideal of being alpha, they actually do embrace black masculinity as opposed to a more like aristocratic ideal, like an aristocratic European ideal.
Absolutely. They see they're kind of, you know, a young man, let's say he's had no experience. He sees a black guy talking about, you know, I smacked this bitch, blah, 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 blah. That's going to be a stand-in. You know, that could look very appealing and be his kind of stand-in for, all right, that's masculinity. And, you know, Gen Z, which is already swamped in this kind of, you know, hip-hop culture and stuff like that, I could see that being very appealing.
It's interesting because, like, the left wing says, like, woke and the right wing says based, and those are both, like, black vernacular.
Yeah. Yeah, look, there is that, too. I mean, in general, I think this, we're in a kind of toxic brew right now, aren't we? There's a lot of things that had to line up.
And it's postmodernism where we're right-wing traditionalists, but you incorporate aspects of pop culture. That's like peak postmodernism.
That sounds based.
And again, I'm not even opposed to that. I think I like the idea of like borrowing from pop culture, modernity, and then seeking to like build something concrete from that, as long as it's a good quality. I'm not even opposed to that.
Quality and real, yeah.
Do you think the Manosphere has a kind of a black mentality about oral sex?
Yeah.
I think you must have been saying that in the chat, and I wrote an article actually, that article, The Political Philosophy of Oral Intimacy, if you saw it. But it's interesting to say.
I missed that one, but I'll definitely read it.
I think Francis read it.
Yeah, I liked it. That was really interesting, more articulate than Blowjob King, for sure.
Yeah, like a lot of right wing men have the same mentality.
I don't get it, man. I am pro. Like I said, when you're equating, I don't know. All of this has to do with like I guess these kind of timid guys who want to feel like they're in control of the situation, and I don't know, even though a relationship is a constant give and take, if you've ever been in one, you know, like it's a constant kind of give and take. It's like, it's not like you can't reduce it to like, I don't know, who if you can reduce it to these cartoonish.
So it's like, yeah, like their philosophy is you always have to be like the dominant position in oral sex or you're a cuck.
Yeah, or you're a cuck. It's cartoonish.
Well, James O'Meara wrote this book called The Homo and the Negro, but someone should write a book called The Kind of Linguist and the Negro.
Yes. Khalid, are you going to do that?
Well, I mean, you know, it's also in gay dynamics, it's dom and sub and switch. And switch is you're both dom and sub when you feel like it. And so...
When you
feel like it, switches when you feel. Sometimes you want to be dumb. Sometimes, hey, I want to be a sub. I want it up the butt, you know, or I want it in the mouth. So that's like within gay culture. So, Robert, you should consider the ideology of switch when you feel like you want to be a sub. It's kind of like the ideal of being
gay. Switch is the radical centrist.
Are we going to put three parentheses around that?
But I think ultimately too, it's also in racial dynamics as well. Robert, I'm going to talk to you about this too. So like in gay interracial relationships, you know, it's kind of weird that you have a white boyfriend and black boyfriend. They both love each other, but then there's a political dynamic.
Well, because which race is the top or the bottom? That kind of is like has a political dichotomy of like which ethnicity is dominant.
And so, in my opinion, there's something really liberal and inauthentic about a black top and a white bottom, because the white bottom does oral to feel white guilt while the black top hates whitey and likes it and gets off to it. But organically and authentically, it's beautiful to have a white top and a black bottom, because the black bottom enjoys white culture and the white top appreciates receiving Afro idealism. But that's just taking it to the whole advantage. So I think if liberals have their way and they make everybody the same, they're going to be talking about who's top and who's bottom, even as absurd as in a white guy dating an Asian guy and some tanky DPR tanky.
No, I'm seriously. I think like using these fetishes, it's like that's I mean, obviously the intersectional left talks about these subject matters obsessively, like in queer studies, but like use fetishes as a way to troll both the left and the right.
I like that.
Kind of like, it's kind of satirical, kind of silly, but it's something I wrote for the sequel to the oral sex article. But I say like right-wing trad sex acts are monogamy amongst whites with zero oral sex. So then I would say like white women or white people performing oral sex on black people is inherently left wing. And then I would say like radical centrist sex acts are white men dating women of color with large age gaps. I guess the gay sex where the whites are the oral tops.
Well, you got to make it more guilt and ethics. What is ethical and what is unethical? So black top, white bottom is mostly unethical because it goes with liberal culture. It doesn't exactly mean...
Well, I would say a white person performing oral sex on a black person is inherently promoting liberalism. My stance.
I think it promotes not just... it's artificial. I would say the black man doesn't benefit because he hates whitey, and whitey pleases to the black guy, and so nobody learns about each other. But again, if it was a black bottom and white top, that would be more healthier because both parties would benefit, and I think that would benefit racial.
And another thing is, like, I say, or like, ugly people performing it on attractive people is kind of an interesting concept to promote. Kind of like...
Oh, that's weird because I remember we were talking with Harlan Venison, and there was... I think I might have sent you this. This might have been 2 years ago. It was porn of a white guy having sex with a black midget, but he was having sex with the black midget, this was 2 years ago. I have the chat, and then he was...
What kind of websites are you on?
And so the point is...
I remember this. The
ugly aboriginal black woman, like we talk about, was with a nice, normal mid-white guy, and it was beautiful because it was a nice guardian for an ugly... And so you just
say it's like an analogy for like a political arrangement based upon like noblesse oblige.
It's more like aristocratic, noble virtue ethics, yeah, of the Christian spirit. Saying, okay, I know you're small, black, aboriginal, and midget, but I still love you, and we're going to have freaky sex, and she likes it, and it's arousing. I think that is the arousal there, and most on the right don't understand that.
Yeah.
So it's like going on Twitter, there was a Twitter post of, okay, could you imagine this handsome Aryan man
having
sex with him?
This is like radical centrism, so like the idea of like, you have a scenario where like an ugly woman or like an average woman might perform that on a Chad, and that's probably somewhat common. But like the idea of incels performing cunnilingus on Stacey's, like that's not realistic. But I think it's interesting to promote kind of like, In a symbolic sense, because it's like it's a reversal of hypergamy, but it's also promoting kind of interesting arrangements. So like I would say that's radical centrism, or like I would say that the idea that like an ugly person receiving oral from like an attractive person is almost satanic, but reversed is maybe something beautiful because that person who's low status, they're in a submissive position, but they're being like granted access to something higher. So that it's an interesting like political metaphor.
Mm. In the realm of abstract ideas, yeah. We're talking about this potentially being in practice, but yeah.
It's symbolism, or you're saying it could be an interesting practice to promote, like to kind of solve a lot of the like resentment and gender wars and inequality?
Well, I think all of us have touched on both prospects.
No, I actually do. Like, I don't know how realistic it is, but I think it should be encouraged.
It could be.
So yeah, I'll continue with like my outline on the politics of oral. So it's like radical centrist sex acts, white males dating women of color with large age gaps, with involving cunnilingus, gay sex with white chads as oral tops as radical centrist, cunnilingus involving white Stacies and men of color, and incels that are the most subversive are also radical centrist sex acts, white. So rich women receiving from poorer men is symbolically neoliberal, but not in practice. So basically,
that was fun. That it was just when I read that on the outline, I liked it. It's an interesting.
So basically, interesting. Yeah, like co-opt the right wing by empowering white males, co-opt men of low status men of color by giving them access to cunnilingus with white Stacies, co-opt the feminists by talking about oral sex equity, which I think is subversive because it goes back to that strategy, you co-opt the other side rather than fight them as reactionaries, and then co-opt the neoliberals by promoting poor men going down on rich women.
Well, I must say, at the risk of being braggadocious, I've been able to do okay in a world of sexual anarchy, like a true anarchist.
So you co-opt, the strategy is co-opt, find a way to co-opt every single, like, ideology using, like, fetish culture.
Mm-hmm. The Black Queens will sniff around. They are they are interested in white boys, too, in my experience.
What do you think about the angle, promoting the angles with, like, incels as subservient to Stacies as a kind of, like, reversal on hypergamy, but also a way to troll by promoting it, like, as feminism, but with oral?
Well, the one that resonated with me was the kind of affluent women and that whole kind of, when you turn that on its head, I thought that was very clever.
It's symbolic. You said it's symbolically neoliberal, but it's actually, in yeah. principle, it's actually subversive.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's interesting to kind of think about.
And also the angle of, like, co-opting feminism rather than fighting feminism as a reactionary like the Manosphere does, like co-opting it to kind of serve different needs and desires, but to co-opt their dialectic.
I wouldn't promote, me personally, I wouldn't promote such a thing because I think that there is a pure... I mean, here's my take on feminism. Real quick, I'm just going to go into this real quick. It's been all right, and allow me to use some feminist rhetoric, even.
Fine, yeah.
The patriarchy, you know, kind of swept, you know, the traditional, you know, when the patriarchy, which I would argue is still, you know, running things, when they swept kind of women's issues to the wayside. With gay stuff, with kind of gay issues, all, you know, just wipe that to the wayside. What they did was they allowed that to kind of like grow into this warped, we get like this kind of shrill feminism, like some strains of feminism are real mutated and very strange. And I would argue that's because
it's constantly mutating from like the first to the second wave, third, and like whatever we are on now, like Me Too.
Right, right. Well, I think, yeah, we're arguably in...
A new wave of, like, feminism with, like, the age gap hysteria, which is more, like, puritanical. So, like, as, like, switchery, the idea of, like... So the idea of, like, a middle-aged man going down on, like, a college woman is, like, subversive.
Well, that's very kind of...
But switchery. You'd say it's switchery.
Right, right. Well, my point is, what I would say is it's been developing in this way, and there is a pure feminist, there is a possibility at, I think there is a there. I think feminism has a right to exist. I wouldn't, you know, I'm not agreeing with that.
You think that there can be like a compromise, or you think that in its current form it's a cancer? Or you think there's some nuance and compromise?
I think there's some... There are strains of feminism that I see no issue with as they exist today. Now, would I want there to be a compromise? I don't want there to be eternal kind of war. I mean, but this is also kind of natural in a way.
But it's not going to be like a full compromise. It's just, I think it's going to be a continued like back and forth, like some bickering, but some compromise, and that's just how life works.
I think there is a more cooperative way to do things. I mean, there are some rad femmes I even speak to, like, who I've gotten to know pretty well, and like...
And they're weird is they're also pretty racist, too, like right-wing.
There's a lot of... There is a white nationalist rad femme kind of group. Yeah, yeah. Which is an interesting thing, too. And that actually came about because these girls came into these, you know, alt-right spaces, and they came into contact with Fuentes nerds, like, who were just, you know, I don't know. So they almost, like, I think Gio actually was tweeting about this once where...
Oh, right. So what do you think about, like, on the thoughts on, like, the whole kind of arrangement as, like, switchery, but also as, like, symbolism, but also like how it could be subversive if it were promoted.
Symbolically, I like it as a thought experiment. That's kind of where I'm at. I mean, like, but yeah, there's a possibility for all kinds of things. I mean, this as activism, could you imagine that? I mean, that's also an interesting concept. The incels going down on Stacy's switcheroo concept, Stark is proposing, the Starkosphere concept of that, is interesting conceptually, certainly. Symbolically is where I'm at. I'm willing to ponder it symbolically at this point. Now, using that as some sort of like activism or like real world thing is kind of the next step when you dream up things.
But it's more ideas. Like avant-garde, like I see it as like a performance art thing. Like not like political activism, but I think it would be a great theme for like a movie, for like an art film.
I would like to see that play out in that way, yeah. More so than the real world, but yes.
Well, I would say that sexual acts you're talking about, it's a binary, meaning there's two people involved, a man and a woman, or a man or a man or a woman or a woman. These are two different realities, and I think we have to respect the same way we respect that there's a dom, a sub, or a switch.
And I think that actually, ironically, is like, even like with gay culture, like you could say the idea of a dom, you could make the case that that's anti-liberal.
Well, yeah, we've already talked about this before, but I think what we're addressing is, what is it like in that position? So when you're talking about blowjob kings or an oral economy, think about what does it mean to be a woman and what it means to do the oral and say things like, do you have to swallow sperm? Do you spit out sperm? Or do you just suck and that's it? And as a guy, do you feel selfish doing that? Or was it like to be a gay guy doing that? These are all questions within gay culture and as well as what you're thinking about and how this ideal kind of
forces people to take on a specific role.
It's a subconscious thing as well, but it's also not a permanent thing. I think there's many women that do not like the taste of sperm or kind of fear the ideal that they have to suck a penis and swallow sperm because some popular pornography said so.
They view it as degrading.
Right, right.
And I think
we have to respect
love
that.
Changes. Love changes a lot of this, too. I mean,
also, I think, another thing is, like, if someone is love or someone is very strongly desires another person, people will let down their disgust mechanisms. So, like, things absolutely. That otherwise seem very disgusting. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of these acts, if you think about them, they are kind of disgusting, but people will let down their disgust mechanisms.
Love and lust. Both
right.
are powerful in that regard.
I think I do think with like these like oral acts, like I think like with so if you take like fellatio, I think a lot of men will just stick their dick in like just about anything, and that's like more kind of R selected and egalitarian. And then like with the other act, with the other act, it forces them to be much pickier and have standards, which is ironically more right wing. But I would actually say, like, I think it's difficult, but I actually do think men should be pickier.
I can say in my own life I've gone through phases where I guess it fluctuates, but I think I'm pretty picky when it comes to a partner. When it comes to a partner, there's got to be something there, and it's inexplicable. Some of it is inexplicable, but it kind of happens. When it's there, you notice it. But yeah, generally speaking, it would be nice. I guess, are you getting into some eugenic territory here almost?
It could be.
Right, right.
It's an interesting metaphor. Oh, so like it's like some there's like a cast of people who don't reproduce, but they only perform oral. Like that's kind of fucked up.
Like the new eunuchs, this like new breed of eunuchs.
I mean, it's kind of sick, but it's an interesting like it would be a great topic for like a science fiction novel or film.
That's Cronenbergian. That's actually very kind of like Cronenberg, right there. It reminds me of Crash. I mean, Cronenberg didn't write Crash, but yeah.
Well, this is a theme in my novel, but also like using it as like a metaphor for like social and class disparities is a huge theme in like my novel.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool to me. I haven't read Journey to Vapor Island or Vaporfornia, but I know a lot about it like through Pill Eater. And I've been meaning to buy it. The reason why I held off on buying, like, the reason why I don't have it already is I really wanted the cover which had the Pepes on it.
Oh, I'm going to have a new revision at some point that will have that.
Good. That's the only reason.
Yeah. Okay. I guess, like, the things we're talking about is, like, we have, like, all this, like, atomization and social problems, and what is the solution, what is the escape. So there's like the solutions to like atomization. One of them is the people who want to restore traditional patriarchy and monogamy. One of them is like this AI utopia / dystopia where everyone's in VR and having like sex robots and VR sex, but people are still kind of atomized and it's all an illusion. And then like the third solution is coming up with these weird, like, fetish mechanisms that they do grant people intimacy, but in pretty bizarre but also hierarchical ways. So those are, like, three different, like, paths away from, like, liberal atomization.
Yeah.
And who knows, like, maybe it could be, like, all three of them simultaneously.
Right. I think we're going to see more rather than less. And a lot of things going on at once, like compounding issues. So when you said maybe all three at once, I'm going to probably opt for that and probably some unseen things that'll creep up on us. That's generally what I see happening with things. And a lot of things come out of left field to add to the pile. But it's hard to predict. It's hard to predict stuff like that. And, you know, it's funny when I look at old movies and stuff and when things, especially in, you know, science fiction, and sometimes I think fantasy does a better job than science fiction at kind of like the future, like, or a distant kind of potential future or otherworldly place. So it's hard to say, but I think a lot of our thinkers and people who are in these spheres are equipped to kind of speculate on a lot of things, and we're kind of in an interesting position to do so, I think, by virtue of what we're willing to confront. And when liberal society has a lot of blinders on.
I would say there's a common theme with three things you're talking about, in that the system is collapsing. I know it sounds like a cliche Chris Hedges speech about the American empire falling, but there is something to point out that
this isn't Alex Jones populist versus the globalist argument. It's more of a Tony Negri versus the capital E empire argument, in that everybody is mad with a broken economic post-capitalist society where automation doesn't do justice, and I don't think we'll be in the Matrix because there's no such thing as robots that can emulate human, and it's all just a line of C code. What will happen is, like you said, liberalism will implode by what choices you can make, whether if it's TikTok subcultures of race change to another, ethnic change to another, or the transhumanism to marry your dog. All these will become plausible. And then at the same time, you'll have to ask if the Karens out in Lake Tahoe doing the cha-cha slide at their interracial wedding will have enough of this, or that, you know, blacks will have another day in Camden, New Jersey, being aloof and doing nothing, or that Asians will keep getting money and having Eurasians. It begs the question, when we'll live in a historical erasure, and then the next alpha generation will just wake up not knowing its past. I think, as Jay Cereza Giorgiani once said in an esoteric way, Adolf Hitler will be on the dollar bill, not because the future is Nazism, but because people thought of him as Genghis Khan, because of the historical erasure that's happening as of now.
Great show. Before I wrap up, Evie, do you want to plug your YouTube and any other like artistic or other projects that you're working on?
Yeah, I mean, my YouTube, it's kind of an inside joke, but I'm sure it'll be in the info somewhere. Visit it. I mean, I'm happy to have more people there. Maybe I'll work on something that takes a little more time in the realm of YouTube. But in terms of artistic projects, just working on an upcoming book of poetry. More on that later. I'll certainly fill you guys in on progress.
Thanks, Evie and Francis. A great show.
Thank you, Robert Pilleater.
Thank you.